Everybody, and welcome to Hauntings, Murders, and Mimosas. This is Jamie,
Megan, and Morgan.
And welcome to all our ghoulies and our new ghoulies.
With the culties.
I'm sorry. Welcome to all of our culties and our new culties. All right, so check us out on our social media, on Instagram and TikTok. We are running a sweepstakes right now, and we are giving away a hoodie. And the winner is going to get to choose which design they'd like to have put on their hoodie and the color and, you know, the size and everything like that. So once we pick a winner, we'll reach out to that person and get them to give us all their details that they want and get one out to them. But let me tell you, you guys have come up with some great names. So keep them coming. We are enjoying this. I mean, there have been some great names on there. Two or three of them have really been at the top. And we're not going to say what they are right now, but y'all keep up because you're doing a great job. Very, very creative names. I will have to say that. Thanks again for following us on all of our social media platforms and for listening to us. You've been listening a lot lately and we appreciate it. So just, you know, also make sure that you reach out to us. Tell us where you're listening from. If there's anything that you'd like to hear as a story, because we're always willing to help our little culties out and give you guys what you want. So just stay in touch with us, okay?
Y'all,
what?
It's the first episode of the new year.
Actually, this is the first episode of our second season. And we have our first episode of this season that we're getting ready to post. And then this will be our second episode. So,
and we're recording this one in the new year.
Yes. In the right year.
So it counts.
I can't really believe that, you know, this is our second season. And That's all to you guys. Thank you so much. We are enjoying this a lot.
And standing by us when we had our hiatus.
Yes, when we had our unfortunate lapse in recording. You know, we do appreciate that because that is definitely not something that we wanted to do or foresaw it happening or anything like that. You know, the move was out of the blue, and we do appreciate you guys hanging in there with us, and we're not going to let that happen again. So thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting us no matter what. And we do appreciate you guys very, very much. At the end of this month, we're going on our first ghost investigation for this area. And we are so excited about it. We are going to take video and try to get some recordings that we'll post for you guys. And what we'll do is if we get enough recordings, then we'll just post like a special episode with all that we capture on there and with some pictures and things like that. So it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
This
and
will
we
be
have
the,
our hoodies to wear.
Yes. Yes. We are wearing our hoodies, our new hoodies to
Thanks
the investigation.
To
and we'll take some pictures of at least the hoodies. We'll be in them or not. I can't convince these girls to take pictures with me, but well, at least post a picture of the hoodie.
We'll take pictures with you.
Okay.
It's just not ones we like to share.
I'm cameraman.
No, I'm the cameraman.
No, I was cameraman last time and it was fine. Everybody had a good
it
time.
It was fine.
No, listen. No, I had already claimed this long before.
Sweetheart, you were talking to the
you're
OG
the
right here.
You have to be in the video.
No, you're the
I don't
one
have
always
to
convincing
be.
Us, trying
yeah.
to get
you're
us to be on
pictures.
You're the
one that
pictures.
Has to be in the video.
Why do I have to
because
be in it?
Because this
y'all
was
don't.
Your idea.
And you're welcome.
I didn't say thank you.
I didn't request to go there.
It was a great idea.
And I didn't say it wasn't.
Okay, and you're going to have a good
but
time.
But you're still going to have to be in the video. I'm cameraman.
Ugh.
Your idea, your consequences.
Okay, well, I have a camera too, so I will be turning it around and getting y'all in it as well.
Whether or not we post it.
Oh, I'll be posting. Who posts this stuff anyway?
Who edits it?
She edits it, but I post the stuff. So
who edits it?
And where do you think the video is going to go? Does she edit
to
the
Megan.
Video? No.
Yeah.
Are you going to edit the video?
I will mine. She can edit your video, but I'll edit mine. And you will be in it. Both of you.
I'm just going to have my camera on you the whole time then.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. I can't handle that. That's just way too much exposure. Besides, I mean, the whole point is to get ghosts in it, not me, right?
Well, I don't. I'm still not down for the scheduled ghost visit. Well, it's scheduled, so.
No, I'm not talking about the scheduled day that we're going. The fact that the time is scheduled when everything starts.
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to give it a shot and see what happens. We are. Now, my... They say that they always hear something. That they usually always hear something.
I'm not doubting that we'll hear anything. I don't want to.
We need to get a shell for Morgan's stomach so she can just run through the walls and not have to worry about the baby.
It is an old house, so she could just kind of probably tear it.
Probably just blow on and just...
Get one, like the knight armor. Put it over your stomach.
I'll just come in a padded suit.
Just shoot lasers off of your stomach as you run.
Hey, what fends off ghosts?
I don't know, but I'm going to be covered in it.
I don't know.
Well, my physical therapist was telling me about a lot of places for us to go in this area. So we're going to have to make a list and start going to all of them.
Yay!
Get excited, Morgan.
Woo!
Woo.
That was not very exciting.
You gotta be hype, bro.
I don't want something to attach itself to me.
It's not gonna attach itself to you.
Bullshit.
What?
You've had something attach itself to you.
Bullshit. Many somethings.
I know.
Many a something.
But I said it wouldn't attach to you.
You still better not bring it in this home. You're gonna be freaking like baptized before you come in. We'll use the trench out there. We'll just baptize you.
Spray. I do have holy water I carry with us.
Throw some salt on you.
I'll put myself in a salt circle.
You need a protection crystal.
I do have those.
You need a protection crystal. You need a crucifix. You need a cross necklace.
Maybe even some garlic.
That's for vampires.
You never know.
Not ghosts. We have done cryptids so many times. There is plenty of evidence.
What's the garlic going to help? A yeti?
No, it could be a vampire.
Oh, okay. You think there might be vampires there, too?
It's possible.
With you, maybe.
Wow. You think I attract everything,
huh? It might just be one of those energy vampires.
Well, those I have had in my life. There have been some people in my life that have sucked me completely down. Okay, that doesn't sound good. There have been a lot of people in my life that have just sucked all my energy out of me. I almost think they're worse than a regular vampire. I mean, a vampire just, you know, sucks your blood and he's done. He moves on.
But he kills you.
I don't know. Some of these people, though, it's almost as bad.
Yes, it is. It's just a slow death with them. They just suck you dry every day, every time they see you. I don't know about that. Is everyone ready to start with our stories for this week?
Da. Da.
Da. We're rushing now?
Da. Da.
What else can you say in Russian? Just da?
Yes.
That's da.
I don't think I know any other Russian.
До свидания.
Vodka. Vodka. Vodka.
Hey, you know what?
Vodka!
Okay. Story time.
Okay. So my story today is about reincarnation. And I know you girls haven't heard about it, but this is a pretty famous reincarnation. The woman's name was Dorothy Louise Eddy, and she was born in London in 1904. And she was the only child to Reuben, who was a tailor, and Caroline, who was a stay-at-home mom. They lived in a coastal town in Woolwich. When she was 3 years old, she fell down the steps. They called the doctor in. He came and checked her out and everything. And even the doctor pronounced her dead. And he left. And as he was leaving, her parents ran out and called him back because it looked like she was coming back around. Well, technically, she was dead for a few minutes. When she was brought back, so to speak, she started having these issues. And one of them was that she spoke with a foreign accent. It's called foreign accent syndrome, that sometimes if you have like a head injury or something like that, it hits something in your brain that will cause you to all of a sudden speak in a foreign accent or in a different language that you never knew before.
I want that.
I know, right? I mean, just hit me and let me speak. Well, hit me here. Let me speak Italian or Spanish, a little French back here.
I just want a little accent.
But she she started speaking with an accent, and she also started saying that, you know, she was having these dreams of things that she couldn't explain, and she would also beg for her parents to take her home, and they're like, well, you are home. She was like, no, my real home. I want to go to my real home. But they didn't know what she was talking about. They just, you know, thought, okay, well, she's got a crack on the head and she's gone a little bonkers and just went on. While she was young, she would go, you know, to Sunday school with her parents. And she also enjoyed going to the Catholic Church, to the Mass. It was comforting to her because it reminded her of what she called her old religion. Well, she started talking about Egypt around this age, and that she used to live in Egypt, and that the religions here were very similar to that she had back in Egypt when she lived as a priestess. Well, you know, Sunday school and Catholic Church didn't really care for that too much, so they asked her parents not to bring her back. I know, right?
That's rude.
It is rude. Instead of realizing that, you know, maybe this child has some trauma she's dealing with and maybe trying to help her with it, they were like, no, just don't bring her back because we don't like what she says. So
they didn't want her to taint the other children.
Yeah. So her parents never took her back to church after that. But one day her parents took her to the British Museum. There was an Egyptian exhibition there. And they were walking around and she saw a picture of the temple of Seti I. And she told them that that was her home. That was the home that she wanted to go back to. That she was trying to get them to take her back to. But the picture that she saw, she said, I don't understand because it's missing trees and the gardens that used to be around it. This just looks like it's a rundown temple. But then after that, she started spending all of her time at the British Museum. Any chance that she got, she would go back. And she walked around like, and you know, seeing the statues and everything, like she knew these people. And she talked about Seti I all the time and what a wonderful, sweet man he was and everything like that. And while she was there, she met a man named E.A. Wallace Budge, and he helped her learn how to read hieroglyphics. So every opportunity she got, she was in there learning and studying with him. But she lived during the First World War, and after there was a bombing raid, she moved to her grandmother's house in Sussex, and she continued to study ancient Egypt at the Eastbourne Public Library that was near her grandmother's house. When she was 15 years old, she described a nocturnal visit from the mummy of Pharaoh Seti I. Okay, so in other words,
like a dream?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It was like a dream that Seti I came to her as a mummy. And she also started having like episodes of sleepwalking and nightmares. Nobody really knew what to do with her. So she was put in the sanatorium several times because they thought she was just crazy.
Well, I can imagine after a few years of that, her parents probably just got tired of it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, like, not understanding reincarnation or anything like that, but they probably got tired of it.
Especially when she started saying, oh, yeah, mummy. I had a mummy visit me last night, and his name was Pharaoh Seti I. Yeah. Okay, we're going to get you some good drugs. Don't worry, babe. Okay. So she became a part-time student at the Plymouth Art Studio and began to start her own collection of Egyptian antiquities. And during the time that she was also at Portsmouth and the Plymouth Art School, she became part of a theater group, and she performed a story on Isis and Osiris. And that just really got her, you know, thinking more about the goddesses Isis and Osiris, and she started doing more research and everything like that. In 1931, she moved to Egypt after she married a man named Iman Abdel Miguid. He was a teacher that was here, or not here, but he was a teacher that was in London, and he was teaching English. He also went back to Egypt to teach English. So they got married. They went back to live there. And when they moved to Egypt, they at first lived in Cairo. It was said that when she arrived in Egypt, she kissed the ground and announced that she had finally come home to stay, that this is where she had always belonged.
But that could also be mistaken as like some hardcore cultural appropriation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think nowadays, that part of that,
that would not fly.
No, it would not fly now. And I think she really was given a hard time about a lot of this too, because, you know, here's this very English looking woman who was saying that she was actually an Egyptian in a previous life and remembered absolutely everything about that life. You know, she had a lot of skeptics around her. But
where did she meet an Egyptian man? Did she plan that?
She met him at school.
Oh, studying.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was in England studying.
Did he believe her?
Yeah, he did. You'll see, it comes to be that a lot of people actually believe her, but
he brings her home. She's actually Egyptian.
That's right. She's Egyptian, Mom. Don't worry white. About it. She's a little white girl, but she's Egyptian at heart.
She knows how to cook all the food.
She appreciates our culture. Don't worry about it. They had one son, and his name was Seti. Of course, she named him after the pharaoh. And that's where she gets the name of Om Seti, which in Egyptian means mother of Seti. So when she was younger, she would talk about, you know, her visitations by an entity named Hora, whom she claimed was the spirit of Seti the First. And she said that he dictated to her things to write down. So over a period of 12 months, she wrote out everything about her previous life. He told her everything about her previous life. So she wrote a book about it. The story of her previous life that was written by Edie took up around 70 pages of cursive hieroglyphic text. I mean, that's a lot. But she wrote everything in hieroglyphics.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Cursive what? Hieroglyphics?
Cursive hieroglyphics.
Yeah, I didn't know either. I thought everything was just the hieroglyphics. But maybe that's that.
I thought they were just like pictures.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But maybe, I don't know. I've never heard of cursive hieroglyphic. Okay, it described the life of a young woman in ancient Egypt called Bentrishite, who had reincarnated into the person of Dorothy Edie. The story goes that Bentrishite was of humble origin. Her mother was a vegetable seller, and her father was a soldier during the reign of Seti the First. When she was three, her mother died, and she was placed in the temple of Kam el Sultan because her father could not afford her. So basically, just like sold her. There she was brought up to be a priestess. When she was 12 years old, the high priest asked if she wanted to go out into the world or stay and become a consecrated virgin. And she didn't really understand, you know, what they were asking her or what that even really meant. So she took the vows and stayed as a consecrated virgin high priestess. Well, during the next 2 years, she performed in the annual drama of Osiris's Passion and Resurrection. This was a role that only virgin priestesses consecrated to Isis could perform. Well, one day she caught the eye of Seti the First. They became lovers. Eating the uncooked goose is what they said. It's an ancient Egypt term that has been compared to like eating the forbidden fruit. Well, she got pregnant and she told the high priest who the father was. The high priest told her that, you know, the gravity of this offense against Isis was so terrible that she would have to be put to death. So she didn't really want to be put to death because she didn't want to bring Seti into it. She loved him. She was still trying to protect him and everything. Didn't want it to really come out that, you know, he was the father of her baby. So she committed suicide.
Well, that's sad. Oh my God.
I know. So that she wouldn't have to face trial and nothing would come out about him. Mm. You know, she really did love him. She was just trying to protect him.
That's sad.
It is sad. But that's how she died in her previous life, she believed. Well, in 1935, her and her husband separated, and her son Seti stayed with her, and he went to live in Iraq. She moved closer to the Giza pyramids, and she met an Egyptian archaeologist named Salim Hassan of the Department of Antiquities, and he hired her to be his secretary. While she was working under him, you know, she learned more about the Egyptian culture and more about the language and the history and all that. So she worked for him as a secretary, but he was kind of like her mentor. Mm-hmm. And learning all about Egypt. In 1956, she was 52 years old and she left for Abydos. And she felt like that place had a special significance for her because it's where she believed that she had lived and served in the Temple of Seti. She made short trips to the site before, during which she had demonstrated, you know, like having an advanced knowledge of the place. And one of those trips, the chief inspector for the antiquities department had heard about her claims, and he decided he would just kind of like test her a little bit to see if she really knew what she was talking about. He would explain to her different wall paintings that they had found and ask her to identify them. And she identified every single one of them and told him on top of it exactly where to find them and where they were. Huh. And he was like completely blown away because this has never been made public knowledge. They had just found this stuff, and it was just being studied by the antiquities department. They had not told anyone.
Oh, so she basically helped them, like,
she explained everything.
She had perfect evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect evidence.
Not only could she tell him everything that he asked her, but she could explain it too. So the things that they had just found, she was instructing him on it, what they meant and stuff like that. Hmm. So, you know, for her, the Temple of Seti was a place of peace, and it's where she felt secure because she had such a connection to it. She felt like she really was home. Do you remember I had said before that when she had first saw the Palace of Seti in the British Museum, that she had mentioned that she didn't understand where the gardens were? Mm-hmm. Well, she explained to them where the gardens were, what was in it, and everything like that. And they went and looked and found evidence of the gardens that nobody knew had ever existed because they were still buried.
Oh, wow.
So she told them all about that. And when they started doing the excavations, it matched every description that she said.
That had to be so exciting for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and this one random person just comes in and then they find out all this stuff about the place that they have lived in most of their lives.
Right.
If not all of their lives.
That was probably exciting for her, too, because it was like validation.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, I don't know if I ever told y'all, but I had always wanted to be like an archaeologist when I was younger until I found out I had to go in, you know, tight spaces. And then I was like, no, I'm good. I'll just read about it. It's all right. But can you imagine how exciting that would be?
Oh, yeah.
To be living in an area like that, that you have a glimpse of something that you might find. And this woman comes in and sits down and goes, okay, here are the gardens. Here was this. If you go here, you'll find this. If you see this picture or this hieroglyphic painting, it means this, and you need to go that direction or whatever. I mean, she knew all of this stuff.
She made it really easy for them, mm-hmm. too. They got she did the hardest part, was finding everything.
She did. And it was even said, you know, about her that she may not have been given a lot of the credit that, like, Egyptologists were and everything, and archaeologists were given at that time. But without her, they would not have been able to make some of the discoveries that she did. And she told them at one time that she actually knew where Nefertiti's tomb was, too, and that she was buried near King Tut, but that Seti had told her in one of the dreams that they had and everything, the family didn't really want anyone else to know where her tomb was because it was a way to protect it. And there had been so much, you know, pillaging and antiquities and stuff being stolen and things like that. And she said that maybe one day she would tell them about it, but she died before she ever told them. But she said she knew where her tomb was. And she also had said that although she couldn't explain how to do it, but, you know, the Sphinx,
mm-hmm.
she said there was a way that on the top part of the Sphinx and the head part of it, that could open, and that was kind of like a records room, and that every pyramid was built with a records room in it. So whatever pharaoh that pyramid was built for contained like all of his records from his reign, family, everything like that.
That shit is so exciting.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if she couldn't figure it out or that wasn't knowledge that she didn't have in the past life. She knew it was there, but she didn't really know how to open the head of the Sphinx in order That's for really them cool. to get to it. And I'm surprised somebody hadn't just gone in there and just you know, chopped a hole in it and see what they could find. But everything else she said was spot on. So who's to say that wasn't too?
That's really cool.
Yeah, so that's the reincarnation in life of Dorothy Eady. I always thought this was like a fascinating story.
And it was a really good story.
And learning more about it this time around, I did not realized the first time I had heard about it and was reading about it and all that, that she had that much knowledge mm-hmm. and that she was that much of a help to everybody. I just thought, yeah, she thought she was reincarnated as high priestess and, you know, she died and she knew a few things. But I mean, she really should have been credited with a lot more than what she was credited mm-hmm. with. But they didn't credit her with that. For one thing, she was controversial. Another thing, she was a woman and they had nothing to substantiate, you know, what she was saying other than what she was saying and finding it. But everybody was so skeptical about it. They just never really gave her the credit that she was mm-hmm. due. But I wish that she had been able to tell them about all these other secrets and things that she knew. That's and if so they could have found that records room in the head of the Sphinx.
It would have been really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Good story.
Thank you. So what do y'all think? Do you think she really was reincarnated high priestess?
I
mean,
I don't really see it like a way she wouldn't have been.
Yeah. Not with all that knowledge. I mean, and the strange thing is that this all started when she was 3 years old. She never would have been able, you know, this was like, she was born in 1904, so it was 1907. They didn't have TVs to watch or mm-hmm. internet to get stuff off of. This was firsthand knowledge to her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she went to the British Museum and
things that no one else knew.
Right.
Yeah, especially archaeologists from Egypt.
Mm-hmm. I believe her story just simply because of all the things that she was able to tell people. Where to find things
yeah.
and what they meant. And the fact that she was able to tell, you know, the Egyptologists places that they didn't even know existed. They didn't even know that Pharaoh Seti's temple even had gardens until she mm-hmm. came. So
that's really cool.
Yeah. So I think we need to go do our past life regression now.
I thought you were going to say we need to go to Egypt. I want to go to Egypt.
I've always wanted to go to Egypt. Well, there's a lot more stories that I could have put in there, a lot more things that she had said. But like I said, it would have gone on forever. I took out pages and pages of stuff. So what are we talking about today, Morgan? What's your story about?
I'm doing a case on Sherry Rasmussen.
Uh-huh.
And this case took place in Van Nuys, California. On February 24th, 1986, Sherry Rasmussen. She was married to a man named John Rutan, and they had just gotten married that previous November. And in February, he came home from work one day and found her dead in their living room in their condo. Like I said, they had just gotten married. They'd been engaged for a little under a year. They met in 1984. Their relationship moved pretty quickly, but they were both very successful people. He worked at a mechanical engineering company, and she starting college at the age of 16.
Wow.
She graduated at 20, I believe, and then before she was 30, she was the director of nursing at Glendale Adventist Medical Center. So she had
really
done
smart.
Yeah, she had done really well for herself.
Good for her.
Yeah. But they were both really happy together, and they were in love. He said that he really enjoyed her spirit, and a lot of other people that knew her said that she could walk in a room and just light it up. She was just a wonderful person, and he said that she was the person that he wanted to be, and that she brought the best out in him.
Why do people like that have to have their lives taken away so early?
You know, he was heartbroken when he saw her. So, kind of soon into their relationship, they had met in spring 1984, and a little later in their relationship, she kind of found out, it wasn't really like a big deal, but she found out that he had had basically a friend with benefits beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And,
before
you know,
they married or before they met?
Before they met. I think it was still going on a little bit when they met,
mm-hmm.
but I think after that he kind of called it off. But she had learned that he had a friend with benefits. This friend with benefits didn't know that he had started dating this person and ended up throwing him his 25th birthday party. And she was kind of more into the conclusion that their relationship was like together, but he was very adamant about it not being a relationship, that they were just kind of like dating around and they were just friends with benefits. Her name was Stephanie Lazarus, and she was actually with him for a little while beforehand. And when he moved to California, she actually applied at a police academy and became an officer for the LAPD.
So she followed him?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. Well, she hesitated on that, didn't she?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess she did follow him, and she kind of was thinking that the relationship was a lot more than it was. Like I said, she threw him his 25th birthday after he had started dating Sherry. Uh-huh. You know, that would make anybody really uncomfortable, yeah. And Sherry didn't really like it, but she never said anything to him about it until Stephanie kept asking John for favors. And in this one instance, she had asked him to wax her skis.
I thought you were going a totally different direction.
Wax her cooter.
Yeah, that's where I have my head.
Wax her knees.
Wax her butthole.
Her skis. And when she had come to drop them off, she was apparently in like workout clothes, mm-hmm. and it kind of made Sherry uncomfortable. And
were they skimpy workout clothes?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like a bra, or I don't know, this was the 1980s, so maybe not that.
Well, no, I mean, 80s was like that big fitness thing, and everyone wore the like the tight workout clothes and the warm-up socks. Oh,
yeah. So she was in like really flattering clothes, and it made Sherry really uncomfortable. And she had kind of like mentioned it to John. He was just like, it's fine. It's just a favor. It's not anything that you need to worry about. And one day she had come after John went to work to pick up her skis, and it was just Sherry home. And she was in full police gear, and she was like armed and everything. And she came and picked up the skis, and it made Sherry very uncomfortable. And she mm-hmm. spoke to John again about it, and he was just basically like, it's nothing you have to worry about, just try to ignore. I would have been pissed.
Yeah.
I would have been pissed.
No other woman should show up at your house with a gun.
No. I mean, I don't care if she's an officer.
Or warm-up socks.
Yeah, like I said, she had asked John to just stop communicating, and he told her just not to worry about it. And Sherry just kind of, she was scared of Stephanie because she was, I guess, so bold with her actions, and the fact that she was a cop and she was armed most of the time. So like, it just scared her. And the fact that John was more or less just like, get over it, kind of just didn't settle well with her.
I wouldn't have me either. Mm-mm.
So on February 24th, 1986, Sherry had actually a presentation that she had to do at work. And what the presentation was about, I'm not really sure. I saw something about it being a motivational presentation. And I also saw something about it being like presentation on like a study that she didn't really believe in. But either one, she didn't really want to go. She didn't want to do the presentation. She wanted to call out sick. And she called John and was just like, I might call in sick. She had gotten hurt the day before in aerobics, and she hurt her back. And she was just like, I might use that as an excuse. And he was just like, you should go. It'll be fine. Just get it over with. But she actually did end up calling out. Nobody had really heard from her that day. He had tried to call her multiple times that day, and she never got an answer. Her sister, Connie, also reported calling her once and not getting an answer. And when John got home later that day from work, their condo was two-story, and the whole bottom of it was the garage. And when she went inside, it was the second story with a balcony right over the garage. Mm-hmm. When he got home, the garage door was completely open, and her car wasn't in there, and he had just gotten her this new BMW for their engagement.
How come I didn't get an engagement present like that?
Yeah, right?
I barely got a ring. Nobody bought me a BMW.
So he'd gotten home and the garage door was open and her car was missing. In the 80s, everybody had a home phone. So he was kind of confused as to why she left and didn't turn on the answering machine, because if he would have called, he would have been able to leave a message, but he wasn't able. So he went inside, and when he walked in, he found Sherry on the floor, and there was glass everywhere, and she was just bloody and she had been shot.
What a horrible thing to have to come home and find.
Especially when you think that she's not there.
Their balcony door had been shattered. The sliding door had been shattered due to the shots being fired. But when the examiners saw her, they had figured out that she had been hit over the head with a vase. And she'd been hit in the face with the muzzle of a gun. She'd been bitten in the arm, and she had gotten 3 shots to her torso.
Good grief.
And they even found that the gun had been shot through like a quilt to muffle the noise, which it did, because her neighbor reported seeing the garage door open at 9:45 in the morning. And
a maid cleaning another condo nearby said that she heard fighting and yelling and everything, but nobody heard a gunshot.
I guess it's not a standard issue for a police officer to have a silencer.
So when they had done the investigation, they had seen signs of the attacker attempting to tie Sherry up. But Sherry was 6 feet tall, and she was a really strong, healthy woman. And after analyzing everything, they figured out that this fight could have taken up to an hour and a half.
Oh, wow. God, she fought that long for her life?
When they were also looking around the house, they found a bloody handprint next to the panic button on their home security system, but not quite on the button. So she never got the chance to press it and call for help.
That's sad that she was so close, though.
After looking at everything and seeing that electronics had been unplugged, things had been, like, kind of moved around a little bit, but nothing of significance was really taken except for her and John's marriage license. It was the only thing that was missing.
Yeah, so you know it was a crime of passion, so they say then. I mean, Berkeley doesn't go in and go, oh, I'm going to leave this big screen TV and all their money in their wallet. I just want your marriage certificate.
The detectives thought because things had been unplugged and things had been moved around and there was a stack of like videotapes and stuff sitting on the top of their stairs. So it looked like somebody had been like collecting things, and then Sherry kind of surprised them, I guess, and they stopped and killed her and ran. So the detectives kind of just came to the conclusion that it was a home robbery gone wrong. They said that she had been found in like a robe and night clothes and everything, and that from that they could expect that she wasn't expecting anybody to come over. It had to have just been like a surprise attack. The case was actually closed pretty quickly because during this time there was a big crack epidemic and gang fighting going on, and the police were very preoccupied with all of that. So Sherry's father, Nels Rasmussen, did not think that her case got the attention that it needed, and it got closed too quickly. He called multiple different police stations multiple times and even offered rewards over the media himself, trying to get any kind of information. There was really nothing of significance that came up at all. And he just couldn't believe that his healthy, strong, tall daughter would have been taken down
that easily.
Yeah.
Well, sort
it
of.
It wasn't easy if she fought for an hour and a half. Bless her heart.
Like, hearing the time, you don't think that it would be that long, but like, doing that much physical labor and fighting that hard, mentally and physically, that's a long ass time.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. That's like the length of more than the length of a movie.
Yeah, but he just couldn't believe that she got taken down by a burglar. So come 7 years later, in 1993, new technology for DNA testing had come out, and Nels actually offered to pay for it himself, but he got denied because they didn't have a suspect. They couldn't do DNA testing without a suspect's DNA. And he actually told them multiple times that, like, Sherry confided in him that she was scared of Stephanie.
Yeah.
And that at one point, Stephanie had shown up at her work at the hospital and basically told her that she and John had slept together again and that if she couldn't have him, nobody could. And John did sleep with her during his and Sherry's engagement.
Really? And she knew about it?
He did tell her about it, and he asked her not to call off the engagement. But he said that Stephanie called him kind of, I guess, shocked at the fact that he was dating somebody, and she was just really upset, and he said that they slept together for, I guess, closure for her. But I don't know, that wouldn't have been a good enough excuse for me. But he did tell Sherry, and she agreed that she wanted to stay with him, and they ended up working it out. Nels told the cops multiple times that he wanted Stephanie to get looked into, but everybody had such a hard time believing that an LAPD officer could have anything to do with it.
Not like she didn't have motive or anything.
Yeah.
So the detective that was in charge of this case at the time, Lyle Mayer, he ended up closing the case just because he didn't think there was going to be any new evidence or anything coming along. So he closed it and eventually ended up retiring. And it went to another detective, and he again opened it and thought that nothing of significance would ever come up. So they closed it again. So 3 years after the murder, Lazarus opened up her own investigation firm called Unique Investigations. And 2 years before that, actually, she earned some medals and one gold medal in the World Police and Fire Games. She also married a fellow officer. They adopted a daughter together. And eventually went to become a police academy instructor. So she was continuously busy and like bettering herself in her career. And she made a really big name for herself because of how involved she was. Come 2004, a criminalist named Jennifer Francis decided to pull out the case and kind of take a look at it herself. And they had one swab from the bite mark that they found on Sherry's arm, and they had one swab of DNA. With the new DNA testing that they had had in 2004, she was able to identify that the attacker was a woman. There was speculation about it being a woman beforehand because biting usually isn't like a male trait.
Right.
Usually it's a female attack. They didn't really have the testing then, so they decided to just make it a burglary of a man. And with this, she was able to figure out that it was a female. She found notes about Sherry being harassed by a female. It didn't really say who the female was, and she decided to ask one of the other officers about it. The officer that she asked was just like, oh, you mean the LAPD officer or the detective, because at the time Stephanie had become a detective. And he was like, oh, you mean the LAPD detective? And he was like, no, she had nothing to do with this. So Jennifer had to put it away because nobody else wanted to look at it. And again, the case went cold. So in 2009, the drug and gang stuff had kind of slowed down. Crime had slowed down in LA. And there were two detectives, one named Jen Nuttall and Pete Barba. They decided to reopen a cold case and they chose Sherry's. And not really having much to go off of, they decided to start from the very beginning. They had the notes that were taken when Sherry was found, and they had the notes about like everything that was set up in the house and what was missing, what wasn't missing, everything like that. And they found a lot of pieces of information that just weren't really consistent with burglary. There was no forced entry, there was nothing missing, and nothing had really been gone through. Like, things had been moved, I guess, to look like a burglary, but nothing had really been, like, ransacked.
Right.
So they decided, with Jennifer's finding of it being a female suspect, they decided to make a new list of female suspects, and it was five women. And they went through most of the women. There was one more that they had to investigate before they went on to investigate Stephanie, and they got a DNA sample from her, and she just wasn't matched to the DNA. So at this time in 2009, while they were looking through the case and everything, they actually called John again to ask about Stephanie, but he had informed them that she was a detective at the time, and she had actually moved up more going in commercial crimes, and she was doing art theft at that time. She had recently recovered a statue that had been stolen. So she was in the news, she was in the paper, she had really, really made a name for herself. She was an involved member of her neighborhood. She was also a member of the LA Women Police Officers Association. So she was very well known, very respected, and she had accomplished a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And John had told him, yeah, like, she's a detective now, and like, this is all that she does. Knowing all of that, and her being the last suspect that they had to be very careful because they couldn't just go out and blame her and blame another officer. But they also had to be really secretive about the case because they didn't know if anybody was in the station that, like, if they were friends with her and if they would, like, tip her off that they were talking about her, or, you know, she had a husband in the field as well, and he could have also had friends that could have tipped them off.
Mm-hmm.
So during their reinvestigation, they had to refer to her as number five just to keep everybody out of it. They couldn't work on the case during the day. They had to work on it late hours and behind closed doors, just the two of them. So again, after they had done the DNA testing for the other woman before Stephanie, they went to their superiors afterwards and told them that Stephanie was their last suspect. They made this plan to get a voluntarily discarded piece of DNA that she had drank out of a straw, and they went and just grabbed it out of the trash. This allowed them to collect a sample of DNA without having to get a warrant,
mm-hmm.
and tipping her off that they were onto her. So they collected that and they ran the test, and she was a match for the bite mark. In June 2009, they had actually gotten dozens of officers to wake up in the morning and just told them where to go. They didn't tell them what the case was about. They didn't tell them who was involved, but they all got up and went out to Simi Valley in California, which is where she lived, and they set up this whole investigation. So they called her to the Parker Center, which was their department's headquarters, and at the Parker Center. To enter, the officers have to surrender their gun and equipment. So this made it more of like a safety thing for them, just in case like she would retaliate. After she had been called, they told her that they had somebody in custody that needed to talk about an art theft with her. So she got there, she checked her stuff in, and then when they brought her to the room, they actually told her that they needed to talk about the Rasmussen case. And she was confused and kind of caught off guard a little bit, and she claimed that she didn't really remember much, but as she kept talking, she kept remembering more things.
It's because she was there and done it.
The video that I watched of her getting interrogated at the Parker Center, bro, she looked guilty as shit.
Really?
She was like jittery and she was stuttering, and I was just like, well, you're supposed to be an officer. You're supposed to know how to like get past these things. But the detectives that were questioning her were Greg Stearns and Dan Hadamiel, and they actually were very scared that she would kind of just like ruin the interrogation because of her knowledge of like the interviews and everything and their tactics and her knowledge of the legal rights that she had to not speak and all of that. But she spoke all of the case and everything that she knew and continued to keep remembering things until she got to a point where she was just like, are you accusing me? And her mood kind of changed, and they asked her they were like, if we asked you to give a DNA sample, would you give it to us? But she said, maybe, but I feel like I need to talk to a lawyer first. And after she said that, she got up and tried to walk out of the room, and then she was arrested by two officers waiting by the door. After she got arrested, they got a search warrant for her car and her home. Mind you, this arrest took place 23 years after the fact.
Did she even still have the same car?
I don't know. Well, also remember that Sherry's BMW was missing. She didn't even use her car. But while they were searching her home, they actually did find a journal from the time of the murder. Obviously, it didn't mention anything. And when they'd found it, they had found entries about her love for John and her disdain for him getting engaged to Sherry. They also found on her computer that during that time, she had looked up John's name multiple times on the internet. John had also mentioned at one point that when they were seeing each other, that she would steal his clothes while he was in the shower, and she would often take pictures of him while he was sleeping naked. So why they didn't decide to look into her further, I think is corrupt. Definitely corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, after a lot of the other police force learned about her arrest, a lot of people were shocked, but there were people who weren't as shocked as others because they also reported that she had a lot of anger, and they would actually call her spaz behind her back.
That's an awful name.
I guess because of like outbursts or something while she got angry, but yeah, they would call her Spazarus.
Spazarus Lazarus.
After she was arrested, she was held in LA County Jail, and she didn't have a bail hearing for 6 months. When Lazarus's lawyer, Mark Overland, when he proposed the bail amount, he asked for $1 million, and the judge, Robert J. Perry, actually set her bail to $10 million, saying that she was a high risk to flee the country or somehow obtain weapons from her husband. So they set her bail to $10 million.
That's during no small change.
No, I mean, he was right.
You only have to pay 10% of it, but still, that's a lot.
So during the pretrial, Mark Overland, her lawyer, tried to say that the evidence was basically invalid. And he tried to blame the officers who were involved during the initial case that they didn't follow up with her, even though she was mentioned and she was somebody that Sherry's father said that could have been involved. And there was a witness who was there during the confrontation that Stephanie had with Sherry when she decided to visit her work, and they didn't follow up with her either. And she ended up dying in 2000, so they never got the opportunity. And he said that without her testimony, that there was just a lack of evidence and they couldn't carry on. When he had mentioned that, the whole prosecution just argued, saying that all of the evidence had to be used, all of the evidence that they collected had to be used, and that a timestamp really shouldn't matter on it, considering that it was a cold case.
Right.
And the judge agreed with the prosecution, decided to proceed with the case. Overland, I have to give it to
Salem. He tried multiple times to get the case dismissed, to get evidence barred, and to just somehow
get her free.
Yeah, he was working very hard. He tried at least 6 or 7 different things to try and get the judge to dismiss the case. But Judge Perry didn't really care about any of his points, even at one point stating that he was, or his point was overbroad, basically saying that he was reaching.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2012, the trial began, and Overland's opening statement was actually really, really good, because when I was reading it, it actually had me kind of questioning, because, or it would have had me questioning if I was part of the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And no knowledge of the case at all. He pointed out a lot of flaws that took place during the investigation, and the fact that the DNA swab that they had taken off of the arm was a Q-tip, and I'm not sure whether or not it was in a vial. I feel like it should have been, but it was in a manila envelope that was wet or had a hole in it or something. And he was saying that it could have been tampered with, or it could have been contaminated, or that somehow in handling it, that Lazarus's DNA could have been just put in it by accident, by handling it.
Yeah, they would have just gotten her DNA and just put it in there, and that would have been the only one. Yeah, it sounds like a lawyer.
But he was saying that, like, it was just, it was a very big possibility that it could have been contaminated, or that they really didn't have any other physical evidence that it was her other than that. Paul Nunez, who was the prosecuting attorney, said that this wasn't a fair fight whatsoever because of Stephanie had police training. She was very, very well equipped to do anything. She was armed. She had a gun, and Sherry didn't have anything to protect herself.
Mm-hmm.
He also said that Lazarus had no alibi for that night. So there is a big possibility that she was at Sherry's place. At the end of the trial, Overland basically said that the case was invalid and said that it deserved a mistrial because of all of the lack of evidence and the fact that they didn't really have anything but the DNA to pin onto Stephanie. So on March 8th, 2012, Lazarus was sentenced to 27 years to life in prison, and she was transferred.
Cop in prison. That's not good.
It didn't really say anything about her experience in prison, but I'm sure she had a rough time.
Yeah, especially with how high up in the, like, officers she was.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an art theft detective, that's high rankings. That's a decorated officer.
And you know that you have many of those people have been arrested because of you.
Mm-hmm. She was sentenced to 27 years to life in prison, and she was transferred to California Institute for Women in Corona, California. Later on, after the trial, they had found that a lot of evidence was missing, and there was supposed to be more physical evidence, like blood and everything that they had collected, and there were also recordings missing from interviews with Sherry's father and her sister and everything, that in those recordings, they mentioned Lazarus. So
you think some of the police helped it disappear?
There was an evidence transfer at one point, and it was checked out of where it was, and it was all lost. It was all misplaced.
Well, isn't that convenient?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that was left was that swab DNA sample.
Probably because they didn't think that it had anything really to do with her.
Or they just forgot it.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that was left. And once that came out, Nels and Loretta, Sherry's mother, decided to file a lawsuit. And also Jennifer Francis, the criminalist who worked on her case in 2004, she decided to also file a lawsuit against the city on the grounds that she had suffered a lot of harassment from her superiors trying to report her findings, and there was just a lot of scrutiny from them.
Probably affected her advancements or anything like that too.
Well, it smeared her name too, because she basically tried to smear another officer to officers.
Right.
So it hurt her reputation too.
Even though she was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Did she win her case? Do you know?
Yeah.
She did.
The case kind of ended in favor of somewhat her and the city. It said that there had been a lot of other high profile cases that had been tampered with, and that this was just one of them. So I think there was some kind of compensation for her. The lawsuit that Nels and Loretta filed was dismissed.
Of course it was.
Yeah. So they, after like their lawsuit and trying to like get the judge to file the suit against this city because of the tampered evidence and because of all of the officers that probably were involved in making all of the evidence disappear, they just decided to not do it. And they decided to not even do the case or go to trial for the suit.
That's so sad. I mean, they lost their daughter. They got screwed when it was first investigated. Then they find out that it was investigated poorly, to be nice about it, and then just get screwed over again.
23 years to find peace or
some sort of closure. Yeah.
Well, when they dismissed the case, they basically was just like, considering the time and everything and the fact that it went cold, all of this other stuff, they said that the final year that they would have been able to file a suit against the city would have been 2000. But they didn't even reopen that case.
Yeah. I mean, the case was still like a cold case. Yeah. They weren't doing anything with it.
It was looked over, and I guess that's what they counted as it being like
opened again.
Yeah. But I mean, during their lawsuit specifically, the city pulled so many stunts. They, I don't think, created new laws, but amended their laws to cover their own ass.
Isn't that what they do?
Mm-hmm. So Stephanie has actually been in prison since 2012, and this past November, actually, Board of Parole members recommended her for parole. And right now, we're sitting in the 120 days that their governor, Gavin Newsom, has to deny or approve her parole. And it is possible for her to be released in the next 5 months. So we're going to have to keep an eye on it and
update. We'll have to do an update on that. Yeah. I guess they figured that her object of murder is gone. There's nobody else that she would go after, but still.
I just think it was a whole corrupt case because, I mean, by the time she had killed Sherry, she had made some friends and then went on to multiple different positions, meeting multiple different people that she probably became friends with. Her husband was friends. He had connections probably. So, I mean, this board of parole members that decided to recommend her, I mean, they were probably friends too.
Right. When is she going to prison again?
2012.
I'm sure she's probably going to get released.
And that's just going to
continue the corruption that this case has brought.
It's not even 27 years.
No, it's like 12.
Yeah.
If she gets out this year.
I think this year she's 63.
I don't care how old she is. I think we ought to go wherever they are and protest.
I think, like, obviously what Stephanie did was bad, but, like, I was really shocked by the lack of care that John showed, because after all of this, and you know how Nels was, like, calling the police stations and trying to get them to, like, do everything, John moved.
He just let it go.
Yeah, he just basically didn't want anything to do with it, and he moved.
For someone that says that, you know, she's who he aspires to be.
And the love of his life.
That doesn't seem correct. Well, it makes me wonder if maybe he had something to do with it, too.
But I feel like if he had something to do with it, he and Stephanie would have gotten together.
Or maybe they just decided to go separate ways because it would have been suspicious.
Yeah. I don't know, because, like...
Or maybe they did have a secret relationship afterwards.
Well, he tried to say in court that after Stephanie had gotten arrested for the crime, he was, like, in tears talking about, like, how hooking up with her during his engagement was a mistake and blah, blah, blah. But, like, you did it.
Yeah.
Just because you found out she killed her, you still did it. I don't think he had the care that he claimed he had for Sherry.
Mm-hmm. If he did, I feel like he would have fought harder for her. That was good. That was interesting. Police corruption at its finest.
Exactly. So, Megan, what's your story about?
Okay, so Catherine Mary Knight was born October 24th, 1955, in Tinterfield, Australia. She was born out of a scandalous affair between her mother, who was Barbara Ruffin, and her father, Ken Knight. Barbara had already been married, and she had four boys with her husband when she met Ken Knight, who was actually friends with her husband. After this rough, scandalous affair that they had, her life just continued to follow this trend of chaos, and she grew up with a father who was a raging, violent alcoholic, and he would often sexually assault her mother multiple times a day. Knight even herself claims that she was sexually assaulted by many of her family members until she was age 11. Reasonably so, Knight was considered a bully at school. She terrorized smaller children, and without even learning how to read or write, she quit school at the age of 15 and began working at a clothing factory.
Wait a minute. She was 15 and still didn't know how to read and write.
Uh-huh. I guess she was too busy terrorizing people.
What year did this happen? So she was born in 1955.
Oh.
So she started the job at the clothing factory, and then a year later, she landed what was her dream job at a slaughterhouse, cutting out the internal organs of animals. And she loved this job so much that she reported having her first set of butcher knives hung above her bed in case she ever needed to use them.
Yeah, because that's everybody's dream job.
Mm-hmm. So she just...
That's what I call mental stability.
This was just her favorite thing. She thought that she reached the peak in her life because she got to do her dream job.
Were they Cutco knives?
I don't know. Was that around then?
I don't know. I mean, if it was from Australia, they were probably something more like daggers.
So, Knight met her first husband, David Kellett. She met him while she was working at the butcher shop. And Kellett was a lot like her father in the fact that he was also a raging alcoholic and prone to getting into fistfights. And unbeknownst to Kellett, he had the idea that Knight was not as tough as she was. And he was really shocked that on one occasion, he was in a drunken fistfight and she actually joined in with him. And that's when he realized that she was a lot more dangerous with her hands than he actually thought. And he ended up actually being the one that was dominated in the relationship. It was very toxic. Lots of fistfights and drunkenness and aggression.
You go, girl.
Sounds like a dream.
You say that now. So in 1974, Knight convinced a very intoxicated Kellett to marry her. And through this entire time that she was convincing him to marry her, her own mother warned him about the severity of Knight's temper and even stated that her own daughter had a screw loose somewhere.
That's pretty bad.
That is very bad.
So on the night that Knight and Kellett's wedding, they consummated their marriage not once, but three times, with Kellett falling asleep shortly after from exhaustion. But this was an issue for Knight because she wanted round four and decided to turn over and strangle him.
What?
So Kellett woke up and managed to fight Knight off. And even though they were not even a full day into their marriage, Knight had tried to kill Kellett, but they still stayed married for another 10 years.
What? 10 years?
He's
10 years.
Just a psycho.
10 years.
He must have liked it at some point.
This lady had to have some magical hoo-ha or something. So, obviously, Knight and Kellett's marriage was far from perfect, and Kellett was actually very unfaithful on many occasions. And on one occasion, he actually left his wife and two children in the middle of the night to meet another woman.
I mean, I can't really say that I blame him.
Yeah. So when Knight found out about Kellett's affairs, she drove their two-month-old to the local train tracks and attempted to place the infant on the tracks before the train was due to come. But thankfully, the train never came, and they ended up going home.
What? So
nobody saw her?
I don't know about that one.
She couldn't murder her child by train, so she's like, oh, screw it, let's just go back home, yeah, right?
Forget it ever happened.
No.
Why was she out on the street?
It gets worse. She also threatened many people with a stolen axe, and she was shortly diagnosed with postnatal depression after witnesses saw her violently pushing and swinging her second child's stroller down a busy street. So then she was reported to have spent a few months in the psychiatric hospital, and this is where she told nurses that she had intentions to kill the mechanic that fixed Kellett's car because it allowed him to leave in the middle of the night. It wasn't Kellett's fault. It was the mechanic's fault.
Yeah, right. I blame him too, wouldn't you?
Despite all of this, Kellett took Knight back after she was released from the hospital, but their reunion didn't last very long, and Kellett eventually left, with Knight being in a deep depression.
Did he leave the children?
Mm-hmm. He left everything.
Now that's
He's
just
a piece
wrong.
Of shit too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is, because if he knew what he was married to, and he didn't take those babies with him?
Mm-hmm. He just wanted to go out and get some hootenanny.
Yeah, he just wanted some a baby strength.
So in 1986, Knight got into another toxic relationship with a man named David Saunders. Saunders shortly after moved in with Knight and her two daughters, but decided it was best to keep his own apartment, which was smart. After moving in with Knight, he realized just how toxic and violent she was. She was constantly incredibly jealous and suspicious of what he was doing, which is understandable with Kellett and his affairs. And at one point, she felt like she had to show him what she was truly capable of, and she slit the throat of his 2-month-old dingo puppy right in front of him. And they still stayed together.
What?
And had a daughter a year later.
Oh my God, these men are so stupid. Are you that desperate?
I used to think, you know, it'd be kind of cool to go to Australia, get you a man with an accent. Every single freaking one of them are stupid.
That's what I'm saying. I feel like she had to have had some magical hoo-ha to have kept these men after all her craziness.
It must have been. It must have had unicorns floating out of it.
So shortly after their daughter's birth, Saunders left Knight because she attempted to kill him with a pair of scissors.
Oh, that was his breaking point.
That was his breaking point. Not when she slit his puppy's throat in front of him, but when she tried to kill him.
I'm sorry, did you say it was a 2-year-old or 2-month-old?
2-month-old.
Oh, solid. Cool.
2-month-old cool, baby cool. Dingo puppy. Yep.
Cool, cool, cool.
No remorse, just...
Here, here's your puppy.
I'm sure she used her favorite butcher knives, you know.
Yeah, the ones that she hung over her bed.
Uh-huh. So.
Don't you think that'd be a warning for some man?
You would think.
At least that she'd be into some weird sexual things. Like
you would think.
Something.
All these men. So Knight met another man after Saunders named John Chillingworth, and they dated for 3 years. She had her first son with him, but they shortly ended their relationship afterwards due to Knight having an affair with a man named John Charles Thomas Price. So unusually so, Knight and Price had a very uneventful and uncomplicated relationship to begin with. Price had 2 older children that lived with him, and they seemed to be very fond of Knight. Price was a minor, so he was able to have enough money to keep Knight comfortable, and they moved in together in 1995, continuing to have smooth sailing relationship until Knight suggested that they get married, and Price declined.
Uh-oh. He did.
This is when Knight became violent.
Told you.
Not yet. Knight ended up framing Price for stealing things from the company that he worked at, and ultimately he got fired. Initially, Price kicked Knight out, but just after a few months, Price took Knight back with the condition that she could not move in.
So we'll continue this relationship knowing that it won't go further, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Magical hoo-ha.
That's what should be the title of our episode.
Knight's violence began to escalate more and more with Price, and in February of 2000, after an argument, Knight attempted to stab Price in the chest. This led him to take out a restraining order on her to protect him and his children. And at the end of February, Price started claiming that he was concerned for his safety, even went as far as telling his co-workers that if he ever went missing, Knight finally killed him.
Yet you're still with her?
Uh-huh. So on February 29th, 2000, Price came home, did his usual nightly routine, checked in with his neighbors, and went to bed at 11. Then Knight came home shortly after, which I don't fucking understand, because he had a restraining order, and she's still coming to his home. And
how do you have a restraining order on somebody you're dating?
I don't know, bro.
Well, didn't he say he took her back, but she just couldn't live there?
Well, so he but got a restraining order.
You still have a restraining order. Why would you go back?
I have no idea.
What good does a restraining order do if you're still going to allow her to come into your home?
Yeah, if you're not going to follow it.
Yeah. So anyways, Knight came home and she started watching TV. She had her dinner and showered and then proceeded to go upstairs and wake up Price so that they could have sex. And then he went back to sleep. Once Price fell asleep, Knight grabbed her favorite butcher knives that were hanging above the bed.
I can't get that image out of my head.
And she stabbed Price 37 times.
37?
37. Is
that it? Okay, so she didn't think about that at all.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. According to the evidence, he woke up during the attack, but was unable to fight her off and ultimately died to his wounds. Then, Knight dragged his body down the stairs, where she skinned him and hung his body from a meat hook that they had in the living room.
Are you freaking kidding me?
What?
I don't know why there was a fucking meat hook in the living room. But yeah. She then proceeded to decapitate him and cut up pieces of his body that she later throws into a dish of potatoes, pumpkin, beets, zucchini, cabbage, squash, and gravy. So she made a little stew. A price stew. So she made herself a plate and she ate about half of the plate.
She ate... Okay, so where is your boyfriend's butt cheeks? In my pot pie.
Are you sure she didn't have Kuru before this?
I don't know. After consuming part of her meal, she went and laid on the floor next to his headless, mutilated corpse and proceeds to take a large number of pills and passes out.
What?
Price's co-workers listened to his warning of being afraid of night killing him, and when he didn't show up for work the next day, they called the police. When the police arrived at Price's, they found a passed out Knight in her gruesome crime scene. So they immediately detained her, and she was still comatose from all the pills that she took. And when the police arrived, Price's head was still boiling in a pot of vegetables on the stove.
Oh my God.
They also found two plates that had been served at the table with name tags and realized that she was planning on feeding Price to his children.
Oh. No.
Oh, my God.
Knight claimed to have no recollection of the events that happened or how Price died, but she was quickly charged with his murder. October of 2000, the trial for Knight began, but didn't get very far because Knight suddenly changed her plea to guilty, and the reason behind this was still unclear, but the judges quickly adjourned the case and, without testimony, escorted her to prison that day.
Prison? They should have put her in a psych ward.
The judge ordered that on her papers, they be marked never to be released, and she actually became the very first woman in Australia to be given the life sentence without option for parole. Actually, to this day, Knight is still claiming her innocence and refuses to accept any responsibility for her actions, and she even attempted to appeal her sentence but was denied immediately. She's continuing to serve her life at Silverwater Women's Correctional Center. The end.
Okay, I don't even know what to say to that. Megan, that was batshit crazy.
I know. I was reading this and I wanted to tell everyone so bad. She went through four men that we know of.
I think that's probably the worst one that we have ever had on here. Not because... I don't even know what to say. I mean, the fact that she kept drawing them in, they willingly came and...
And kept coming back.
And kept coming back to her. Okay, but who lives with butcher knives above their headboard and a meat hook in the living room?
Miss Catherine Knight and Miss
Did Price? She live in the slaughterhouse?
I don't know. She might have. She might have.
I'm just going to say the men were stupid, too. Like... There were plenty of signs. Yeah. Plenty of red flags.
Yeah.
Well, you think?
That's what I'm saying. They must have been blinded by some magical hoonanny. Like, that's the only reason I could justify them coming back to her. But even still, like, stop thinking with your downstairs head. Like, ain't no hoonanny worth all that.
They all probably walked in thinking that it was some, like, kink that she had, and they got excited.
I don't know. Maybe they were too drunk to see. No, I'm not even going to say that, because those signs were obvious.
They weren't drunk every single day for years.
I mean, I don't know. They were drunks.
Okay, but they weren't all the time drunk.
Yeah. Price wasn't a drunk, but yeah.
That was an awesome one. Thank you so much for sharing. So, does anybody want stew for dinner?
I don't like stew anyways. I'm never going to like it now.
I think we should make some Morgan some stew.
I think so, too.
She won't eat it.
I'll put it in the crock pot for her.
I should have warned you. I completely forgot that's the pictures that pull up as soon as you see her.
What was her last name again?
Knight.
Catherine Knight.
Uh-huh. But she must have not liked the way he tasted, though, because she could only finish half of it.
Well, she got full quick, you know. Maybe she got a meaty part.
But But this lady had the gall to get some D before she ended him.
Oh, well, you know what? If you're going to take somebody out, you might as well get off before you get rid of
them. I mean, I guess she figured that was the last time she was going to get some.
For a while.
Forever.
Yeah.
I can't understand the whole restraining order while dating.
I don't understand that part.
Or warning your coworkers about your girlfriend.
Yeah. And still continuing to date her.
Was it somebody like me, and why are you with her?
Exactly. Don't you have friends?
I mean, he did because they called.
Yeah, but wouldn't one of them question him? Just a question. But if you think your girlfriend's going to kill you, and you're pretty sure she is because you're telling everybody, aren't you going to make a decision not to be with
her? The only thing I can justify it
is here we go again. The magical
hoo-ha. That's the only thing. Because she didn't really have the looks. She had 3 or 4 children from different men. She was batshit crazy and didn't hide any of it.
Even her mother warned one of them at least. Yeah.
Like, I don't understand. Like, that is literally the only thing that I can come to the conclusion of.
I didn't think it would go that far, honestly.
I can't believe she served the man to his kids or was going to.
Thankfully, they didn't come home.
Can you imagine if they had come home and found him like that anyway?
No.
I mean, by then he was already sliced and diced.
Can you imagine if they had actually ate the meal?
Oh, I would never eat again.
I would vomit for the rest of my life.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you for those disturbing thoughts and images, Megan.
You're welcome.
That was a good story.
Cannibalism at its finest. I don't know. Isagawa was, I feel like, more interesting as a cannibal. This sounds like it was kind of random cannibalism. Yeah, like she just kind of like.
She's like, all right, well, screw it. I've done everything
else.
Yeah,
let's wing it. Well,
Isagawa got a lot of media attention.
Yeah.
And he got like celebrated, basically.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm not going to Australia now. I mean, I was kind of leaning not to go because of the giant spiders and, you know, some of the animals and things that they have. And there's webs that would just mysteriously appear.
Mating season for spiders.
Yes. Mm. Okay. So now I just don't see the need in it because apparently men are stupid. And
you can't go in the water in Australia anyways.
No. There's all sorts of USOs there.
There is UFOs, USOs, UCOs.
What is a UCO?
Unidentified crawling objects.
I don't like those.
There's everything there. I don't want to go. I'm good.
It's also what? Now, UWOs, mm-hmm. Unidentified hoo-ha objects. Yeah.
I'm too scared of the crocodiles.
I'm scared huge. Of Australia.
Yeah. The whole country.
I think the main things that would scare me would probably be the huntsman spiders and anything in the water.
Yeah. And, you know, our listeners in Australia, please forgive us.
But we're not going to come visit you.
No, we're not going to come visit
you. They're wonderful, but...
There will not be a podcast tour in Australia. I am so sorry. We'll have to do it outside somewhere.
We'll FaceTime.
We'll rent a theater, set up a big camera.
We'll be there in spirit, but just not in person.
You are our extended culties.
We still love y'all. Well, ladies, those were some great stories today. Y'all did good.
Crazy.
I'm a little, between you and me, Morgan, I'm a little worried about some of these things that make us big.
We choosing some weird ass stories, girl.
I like the weird ass ones, though.
She leans a lot towards the cannibalism, so I say we just don't let her cook.
We don't know anyone for me to cook, anyways. It would just be us, and then you'd know.
Okay, well, that's good. Or we'll just let her do all the prepared meals. Anything that comes frozen is hers to cook that night. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening. We love our culties. Check us out still on social media. And don't forget to submit your name for the hoodie giveaway, because you guys are doing great with some of these names. Maybe some of these stories today inspired you. But, you know, you can enter the sweepstakes on Instagram and also on TikTok. And check out our website. We're always updating that with our podcast as well. Thank you again for listening to us. We will see you soon. And may all your hauntings be happy. This is Jamie.
This is Megan.
And Morgan.
Stay safe out there, people.
Bye.
Bye.